extension number 11281, reel 12.
Mr. Kelly, reel 12.
When I said to him that there were snipers in the area, and wasn't he worried about them? He said, "No snipers around here." And it wasn't 2 seconds later before there was smack on the wall behind us. And they just shot straight through the window. And it's obvious a sniper had fired at us. And he was very sceptical about it, and It surprised me that they had no sense of urgency about it at all, you know. And when I told them what had happened to me, and I told them that we'd seen some of the airborne people, he didn't appear to believe me at all. So I just asked him for a general direction of where the crossroads were and where his possible location was, and I left them and. I eventually found, without too much difficulty actually, I found our own people again. And although I didn't find my own troop straight off, because they were still engaged in this little move forward against the Germans, and still engaged with them, I went to our quarters, and when I told our people, they said, "You better see the CO." So I went and I told Colonel Palmer what had happened. And whether or not he'd been informed by radio from Captain Stevens from the troop level, I don't know. But he said to me, I'm going to visit the airborne, he said, and I'd like somebody to come with me. He said, as personal protection. So he said, "Will you come back?" So I said, "All right, so, yeah." So we headed back for the airborne, and on the way back we were shelled. Well, no, we weren't particularly shelled as particular targets, but the area was shelled again by the Germans with these small howitzers, because you could hear them bang away, and very soon the shell dropped, so you knew it wasn't a very long-distance weapon. And in the course of the shelling, we were crossing this field, again alongside the hedgerow, in the firm belief that the hedgerow would screen us from any enemy observation. I was surprised to again find myself walking by myself, and when I turned round, there was no sign of Colonel Palmer, and I thought, "Oh, good God, has he been? What's happened to him?" So I ran back the way we'd come. You know, it's only a matter of 75 meters, something like that. It wasn't a great distance, but you kept spread out anyway. You know, you didn't walk together. There was always about a 10-yard interval between people, five anyway. So I ran back, and there he was in the ditch, and he said to me, very curious, he said, "You're not immune, you know, Kelly." So he left me a bit dumbfounded at that, but I assume that he thought that I was just walking along thinking that I'd never get hit by any shell fire, anything like that. But that wasn't the thing at all. It was just you obviously developed this sort of instinct to know that the things are not anywhere near you and not going to affect you.
How far was this from Honfleur?
I was coming to that in a few minutes. I'll just finish off this little bit. We arrived at the airborne place, and I, as I said, I was a bit disappointed with the disciplined sort of way, the discipline in the airborne. I'm not being critical about them or anything like that, because they were good soldiers. But when we went, they'd taken this area, which had been occupied by Germans at one time. And there's lots of slit trenches around the perimeters of the field. And Colonel Palmer says to me, "Wait for me here." So, of course, being a soldier, and I don't stand out in the open, I jumped in the slit trench, and they were very nicely made. They had a place to fire from and to fight from. And then they had a nice sort of living room effect. further back. It was all covered by the ground, all camouflaged. You couldn't see them from there, unless you were very close to them. And it was all very nice. And of course, I just bobbed in and looking in, admiring it. You know, the ours were hastily dug, of course, at the pits that we dug. But theirs had, they'd had more time to do them, you know, and they made a better job. But when I popped in and looked in, I thought, what the hell's that at the back? And there's a bundle of camouflage. And, of course, all the pointing was ever done was with the gun, because it was an extension of your arm, you know, the Thompson submachine gun. And though I had no intention of shooting anything at that time, it's still just... And, of course, I was going to poke it with the gun, this bundle of stuff, you know. And, of course, this camarade, and he was a German soldier. The German soldier just chucked away at the back end of his... of this, and it was obvious to me he was a sniper, although he didn't have any gun with him. He probably ditched that, and he'd probably throw away the sights so that because you know they weren't very well accepted snipers, especially when you were on the receiving end and had been on the receiving end.
So you get a much better chance of surviving.
Yeah, well, or not getting ill-treated, you know, in any way, and pushed about. So he just came out. And I thought to myself, good God, he must never have. They haven't even searched the place. They just occupied it and searched it. So I walked him along in to the first bunch of airborne chaps that I saw. And I said, hey, I said, you take him. I said, will you? I said, I don't want him. I said, and search him. So what they did with him, I don't know. But Colonel Palmer came back, and we came back to our own place, and he told me where A Troop was. So I rejoined A Troop again, and saw Captain Stevens, and he wanted to know what happened to me, you know. So I told him. So he said, "But he said, I'm sorry about that." He said, "You know," he said, "but he said I didn't know." He said that you were isolated like that. But he did go back to look for me. He took a few fellas back to search the ground and have a look to see what happened to me, you know, and search about. And he said, "Of course, he couldn't find you." So with telling him what had happened, he accepted the story, and of course, I suppose Colonel Palmer collaborated if it was required. And then, at that evening, we started a long night march. And that was one heck of a march, that was. I started when it was light, like in the early evening. And it was just a long train, the whole commando following a single file pattern. And the obvious thing was that we had to push on and get to this next town, which was Honfleur, as far as I can remember it, Honfleur. And we marched through the night, and we were so tired that we were asleep standing up. And whenever there was a halt, fellas would walk into the fella in front and then just stand there. And although I didn't run up and down there, I was only one of the file. But I remember there was sergeants, and Sergeant Hazelhurst and Sergeant Stock. Oh no, not Sergeant Hazelhurst, because Sergeant Hazelhurst had been caught by a tank earlier in the day, and he had the very very missed bad fortune to be the tank, whatever it was doing, it swiveled round. And he was in a gateway, and they had the gate posts apparently were big solid lumps of wood about a foot square, and the gate was hanging in between them, and he was crushed against one of these gate posts by the back end of the tank, cracked all his hips, and we never saw him again. He was invalided out, you know, became a casualty that way. So I remember Stockell charging up and down, keeping us awake, and Colonel Stevens, and trying to keep us moving. Because if you stood there for any length of time, and then the order came to move, it was quite possible that people would start moving off, And one fellow would be standing there, and everybody standing behind him, waiting for him to move in the dark. And he wouldn't move because he was fast asleep. But there was a heck of a march that. And I remember we ended up in this small farmyard at Honfleur. Well, he said it was Honfleur. Honfleur was just down the road from us. And we caught it. We got there in time to just stop the Germans from blowing the bridges there. And when we arrived, I don't think we were in a fit state to fight. But we didn't have to, as it happened. So we stayed there for a few days, resting, I think, at least 2 days. Although I never got into Honfleur. And then came the move to the Seine. And we did that by transport. And transport to within a few miles of the Seine. And that was the most horrendous sight I've ever seen in my life. The Germans must have taken a they did take a terrific battering there. And if that was just one road, what were all the other roads like? But the Air Force must have had a field day with them. Because it didn't take much for you to imagine. At first, a stream of traffic heading down towards the bridge across the river. The bridge getting destroyed, or the traffic on the road being shot up by typhoons and aircraft, the Air Force. And that stopped on the road, burnt out, smashed up, and the vehicles behind spewing out left, spewing out right, and eventually them getting knocked out until the distance was so great on either side where it kept swinging off and swinging off. And they were all truckloads. We had to pick our way through them because we weren't going to walk around the edges. God knows how long they were on either side. But one mass of smashed vehicles destroys it. Some of them you might say, were intact. But jammed in between all this mass of equipment and tank guns, everything, and men. And they were just lying all over the place. And there was even one truck with them all sitting in the back. Oh, there must have been thousands of dead men there. And by the time, it was miles as well, it wasn't just there. Miles long towards the Seine. God, it's terrible sight, and we had to pick our way through it to get down to the Seine, to a place where we were going to cross. And it was so bad that our transport, in actual fact, had to go, it was a 24-hour trip for them to go round, to cross over and come back to where, to meet us on the other side. And we crossed by taking little boats down with the goatly boat things that the engineer had. And that was a terrible sight. I couldn't describe it. And when we got down to the bottom, I remember there was an old woman. She's obviously mad. She's jumping and dancing about like an old witch, and screaming her head off and cackling away. She must have been right round the bend, but there was nothing but, as far as you could see, and walking amongst it, the smell was atrocious. And that was how we crossed the Seine, and then we just walked, nothing else to do. We just kept walking and walking and walking, and I can't recollect, it was certainly A troop, never bumped the enemy any more then. And we just walked and walked, and then eventually, when the transport got over the other side and things were getting organised, and we picked up our own transport, we got our own bedding back, and we were getting fed again. We just marched and carried on marching and marching all the time, and until we were picked up by transport, and we were dumped close to the nearest place I can think of, because I visited it actually, was Rouen. And I've often thought of looking at the map and trying to track that down, and too lazy to do it, really, I suppose. But I remember going to Rouen, and you know, the countryside around there was beautiful, and the farmland was absolutely terrific, extensive. And we were there for a few days, and then they decided that we would go and help with the attack on Le Havre. But although we were preparing to move, and we, I think some of the elements had moved off. The Canadians, it was their sector. They managed to persuade the Germans that it was all over, so they packed up. So I was very glad about that. So the Germans packed that up, and then we took over from the Canadians. That's right, just prior to the surrender. And that was a little bit of a fiasco, if you like. It was raining the night we took over from them. And I remember going, and there's a big burly sergeant, a Canadian sergeant. And as I say, we wore I was wearing the Colt 45 automatic. And this fella's eyes were on this gun, and he was offering to buy it off me. And he'd give me the princely sum of £10 for it, which was a lot of money then, because our wages went, our pay wasn't very good. So of course the money wasn't particularly of interest to me then either, because more keeping alive was more important, and that gun was more apt to do that than a £10 worth of currency. So, the thing about it was that in taking over from him, he was handing his position over to me, you see. And he took me out, and he was saying that this is our forward Brent position. And I said, how many men's in that? It's a huge trench. So he said, we have four men in there, he said. And he said, we've got a four-man trench here. And he took me around this field, and I said, just a minute. I said, there's place here for hundreds of men. I said, where's your furthest point forward? So he said, we're at it now. He said, these slit trenches are the furthest slit trenches and closest to the enemy. So I said, that'll do me. I said, we'll do use them. So he said, I'll show you all the others, because you'll have to have your men spread out, he said. And I said, I've only got six. I said, you're saying there's three in there, there's four in there. I said, we've been around dozens of these pits. I said, how many men have you got? He said, 110. I said, I've only got six. He said, six? I said, yes. And he was amazed, he was. And when he came back, he told his officer, and he didn't just tell him, like, say, go up and say, excuse me, sir, but it seems to be a bit of a misunderstanding. He didn't say anything like that. He come back, and in the usual American style, tells everybody, the world, that I've only got six men. So Captain Stevens said, how did this come about? I said, he's shown me all these pits, these slit trenches, and the positions that he's got. I said, and I just said to him, I said, I can't hold all them. I said, to hold the front that he's got. I said, I'd have to put a man every 50 yards to cover that ground. So he said, forget it. So he said, we'll sort it out in the morning. So we took over this position, you know, from this company that they'd had. And the next morning was reorganised completely. Captain Stevens, being Captain Stevens, said, right, let's go and find out where they are. Well, the patrol went for miles and miles and miles and miles across these fields and down these lanes towards Le Havre in the general direction of the town, of the city, and never saw a soul. So the obvious thing was, well, right, pick everything up. Let's go and get a bit closer to them. So we moved. We must have moved a few miles closer to Le Havre than where the Canadians were. And the stories that he was saying about the SS and the things like this that he'd met, yeah, he had me dead worried, he did. I said, well, I don't know how I'm going to do it, I said. And
what stories?
Well, he was saying that the course SS fellas, he had a German Mauser pistol, and he was shocked. Well, you know, he wants to swap that for the fair for mine. So I said, no, don't you think so, no. But it was all talk, you know, with him, you know, with the sergeants, I think, you know. So we discarded the places and we moved our own. And it was during that time that we were that far away from the city. It took you hours and hours to get within close proximity of where the Germans were, and they were in no mood to come out. They were just sitting back and just thinking, well, they'll stop us from getting too close, and they'll fire at us whenever they think fit, and generally avoid any action if no action is coming. So as I say, Captain Stevens, being Captain Stevens, he wanted to find out where they were and know where they were for his own peace of mind. So he went down until we got fired at. And that was done by mortars. At that time, we didn't get close enough for small arms fire, like rifles or machine guns. So they fired at us with mortars, which were long-range weapons. They fired, you know, a mile and a half. So that, at least that satisfied Captain Stevens for a time, inasmuch as that at least he'd attracted their attention. So he decided then in his own way that we would move up closer. So we moved up closer, and we sort of, I suppose it might have been a little factory on the outskirts of the town, although we're still miles away from the actual city itself. That was the extremity of the mortar fire, so that we took up a position there. And in the course of moving around, we'd picked up a German mortar and a lot of German bombs. So Captain Stevens decided, well, let's give them a taste of their own medicine. He said, we went out, he did a patrol, and the Germans fired at him. So he thought, right, at least we pinpointed them now. So he moved around, he got several points to shoot at them. So then he had a little bit of a line of where he knew the Germans were. So he thought, well, we'll engage them now, you know. So we knew how far we could go forward before we got shot at. And we could get forward and then crawl forward and observe them. So we found them in these houses and the little villas on the outskirts of the main city. You know, that's probably well out of the city. And we had established our contact then. So he decided that we'd use this mortar against them. And we'd had a replacement officer. And this fella had come from the commando training school in Scotland, Achnacarry. And he had, he was in the, I think he's in the Prince of Wales Borderers. He had the Prince of Wales, the same as the Boy Scouts, the Fleur-de-Lou, and as a badge. So he was full of, you know, he was a little bit full of himself, you know, and how he was the heavy weapons. He knew all about mortars. So he got the task, you see, of setting this German thing up. So we assembled this, but of course, with mortars, 3-inch mortars and 81mm mortars, you have to bed that thing in quite solid, you know, and the base plates in quite solid, because it's got a heck of a thump at the back of it when the bomb goes off. So He gets this sorted out, and we were behind this little factory type of thing that was to our front, and that was Captain Stevens used to use this factory as an OP, and he could see the Germans so quite clearly through his binoculars then, you know, moving about in their positions. So he gave us directions and said that this chap lined it all up, and he had me and Nutty Sherman as the loaders, you see. And I was doing the loading, and Nutty Sherman was handing us the bombs, handing me the bomber. There was a line of slit trenches where the Germans had used, you know, and they were everywhere, German slit trenches. And this officer said, right, it's all set now, he said, and we had walkie-talkies then, but they were big, cumbersome things, they were. And he contacts Captain Stevens. Stevens says, right, go ahead, fire. And he's observing the fall of shots, you see, so they can correct it. And I pops the first one in, and I noticed that I was the only one standing up. Everybody else was down the slit trenches, and Nutty Sherman, thinking, well, Fowler's all very nice, like, but discretion is better. So he popped into his slit trenches too. So when I looked around, he said, well, there they are, lad. He lined up all the bombs. He said, just drop them in. So I said, oh, me. So he said, yeah. So the officer said, yes, yeah, right, pop them in. He said, I'm in contact with Captain Stevens. I said, you're also in a slit trench. I said, what's the trouble with this thing like? So he said, nothing. So I said, right, Joe. So in it went, and I had fired the 3-inch mortar with our own crews, but they'd set it up. And all I was doing was just having a little practice throwdown. So I threw the bomb down in the approved fashion. And pop, it went off. And I'm standing there looking up, you see. And you can't see them at the extremity of their flight. When they reach their culminating point, you know, you can actually see them. And I'm looking up, following the direction of the bomb. And we're waiting for Captain Stevens to tell us where it landed. And I just happened to look down, and when I looked down, I was the only one standing up. Even the mortar had laid down then, for some unknown reason, and that was lying flat on the floor. So I said to this officer, I said, what's happened here? Like, I said, it's collapsed. Oh, he said, it wasn't bedded in properly. And then there was the scream on the headset, on the handset. So he's listening, and I could hear this yelling through the thing, you know, just garbled. I couldn't actually tell it. But apparently, the bomb, when it had fired, it dislodged the mortar. And on its flight, of course, it was completely off course, and it just missed Mr. Stevens. In his little place to the front, nearly burst on him. He said, "What he said?" He said, "Listen, I'm on your side." He said, and this he was relaying the message to me then. And he said, "Captain Stevens said he's on our side." He said, "Would you kindly not aim it at him?" I said, "I didn't aim it." I said, "It's on the floor." I said, "What happened to it?" So he gets out of the pit then, and we stood it up and we got it. Anyway, we fired about 3 or 4 bombs off and made little corrections here and there. And I thought, oh, this is good, this, you know, lovely. Popped them down. And, of course, they were all getting a bit more courageous then and when it was working. And, of course, they were standing up in the pits then, so there was the top half of the body at least was exposed. And even Nutty Sherman got out of the pits to start handing me the bombs then, rather than let me have to bend down to pick them up.